From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the world of film, 1965 was the year of The Sound of Music, Beach Blanket Bingo, and Dr. Zhivago. It was also the year that The Battle of Algiers was released. It was black and white, deliberately grainy, and documentary in its feel as it recreated the 1950s Algerian independent struggle against French colonials. In that high era of liberation struggles, The Battle of Algiers was a handbook and ultimately a hymn to Third World rebels defying imperial power. The film was banned in France, instigated riots and theater bombings in Europe, and was required watching for America's Black Panthers. The Battle of Algiers disappeared as the romantic 60s glow of the revolutionary faded. Now, a new print of the film has been re-released in the midst of what our guest tonight calls a new Battle of Algiers scenario. As the United States struggles to define its role as both liberator and occupier of 21st century Iraq, 20th century images of the imperialist and the oppressed still swirl, and this 1965 film is still being screened at the Pentagon. Tonight on Point, revisiting the Battle of Algiers, the film, the history, and the resonance today. Joining me now from New York is Jim Hoberman, senior film critic for The Village Voice and author of The Dream Life, Movies, Media, and the Mythology of the 60s. He wrote Revolution, Now and Then, an article about the Battle of Algiers in the January issue of The American Prospect. Good evening and welcome, Jim Hoberman.
Good evening. Hi.
Hi. It's great to have you with us. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Jay Hoberman, Jim, there it is, right in the music at the beginning of that film, pulling us into the tension of a time and place no longer at the forefront of most people's minds. What was it in 1965 when this movie hit Europe and a year and two later when it rippled through the United States that so grabbed people's attention?
Well, the Battle of Algiers is a complicated historical document, and it meant different things to different audiences. I mean, the movie itself is set mainly in 1956, mm-hmm. so it was already a period piece. When it was shown, or rather when it was not shown in France, when it was shown in Europe, it referred back to a still festering wound, which is namely the whole war for Algerian independence. When it was shown in the United States, it had a different kind of resonance because it was it had its premiere here in the autumn of 1967. That was after only months after tremendous riots destroyed parts of Newark, New Jersey, and Detroit, Michigan. And while the United States was involved in its own war in Vietnam.
So the resonance was there, and it was quick. In the opening scenes of this movie, which I recall seeing so many years ago, and the electrifying impact it had then and still has today, we have a very urban Algiers. And, of course, towering above everything outside the European quarter, the Kasbah, where a revolt is brewing. One of the key characters says early on in the film, things will change in the Kasbah, and it very quickly does. Jim Hoberman, take us through the prime movers behind this film, director, producer, and who and how it got done.
Well, the film was directed by Gillo Pontecorvo, an Italian filmmaker who had a history of being in the anti-fascist resistance in the 40s as a young man, and who had been a member of the Communist Party at least until 1956. So he was a committed militant and had some experience of his own in guerrilla insurgency. He was invited to make this movie in Algeria by Sadi Yassef, who was himself an Algerian revolutionary and plays himself in the movie. Mm-hmm. And
of course, this was invited after Algeria had achieved its independence from France.
Yes, of course, independent Algeria. So it was an Algerian-Italian co-production. The screenwriter is distinguished also, Franco Salinas. Is a well-known, committed filmmaker in his own right.
And describe the kind of film that they clearly set out to make here, the film they did make.
Well, I don't know exactly what Sadi Yassef asked them for, but what he got was a movie that really is in the tradition of Italian neorealism. And what I mean by that is it's a movie with tremendous immediacy. And, you know, it has the look of a newsreel, albeit an impossible newsreel, because there you couldn't
the cameras everywhere. It's in all the hideouts.
Yeah.
The spider holes, as it were.
Exactly. But like, you know, Rome Open City and La Terra Trema, the classics of Italian neorealism, it seemed to people as if it were actually happening. It has a tremendous verisimilitude and still does to this day. I think a lot of the movie's power comes from that, although it is a construct. But, you know, they employed almost entirely non-professional actors, and it was shot on location, and the film is very grainy, and the camera's often handheld, and so on.
It's been out of circulation for many years. It's just come back this month. Many of our listeners will not have seen it. We'll come back and look at portions of this, but describe the arc of the story that this film captures, Jim.
It's a kind of a classic story of a revolutionary conversion, in a way. It involves a young man, a street kid, who's known as Ali Lapointe, who comes out of jail and is recruited to the revolution. And there are a series of escalating confrontations between the French and the Algerian nationals. The French employ their own terror tactics. They have a bomb. Or somebody sets off a bomb on the pay of the French in the Casbah. The Algerians respond with their own terrorism. You get to see how cells are constructed, and then in the second half of the movie,
cells as in terrorist cells, resistant cells.
Terrorist cells. And this, of course, was something that was a lot of attention was paid to in the 60s.
We'll talk about that.
So
here you have this mounting tension. France has been the colonial power in the period portrayed here for a century and more already. They're clearly very comfortable. Algiers is a kind of extension of France.
Yeah.
It looks in the opening scenes, it's shot from on high. It looks like it could be a European city with the cars along the boulevard and the high buildings. But the Casbah is different, and the Algerians are at least some vital number of them are no longer willing to suffer that French overlord.
Yes, I think that technically Algeria was a department of France.
As in a province, practically.
Yeah. And there's a lot of reference to the Algerian city, which is the native city, which is the Casbah, and the French city, which is the more Western and prosperous part. In the second half of the movie, the French respond to this urban insurrection by bringing in a new general or colonel commander Matteau, who's based on an actual figure, Jacques Massu, and he institutes his own counterinsurgency, which involves breaking down these revolutionary cells and exacting information through torture.
And here's the point in the film where it turns from being policed by the French police, who have been there for a long, long time. It's escalated to the point where French paratroopers march into the city, and everything changes. Maybe at that point, Jim Hoberman, that you began to see, that many lately have begun to see, from Tariq Ali to Zbigniew Brzezinski, and maybe the Pentagon, some parallels, shifting and dangerous as they may be, between what's depicted in the Battle of Algiers and what the United States is facing now in Iraq?
Well, yes, I think that it's the second half of the movie that probably had the greatest interest for the Pentagon study group or movie club or, you know, that was screening it. And that's because it shows essentially that the French are willing to do whatever it takes to break down the insurgency. And they win the battle, but they lose the war. Mm. I mean, they so completely alienate the general population that the French presence just becomes untenable in Algeria.
Jack, we're going to dive into this story tonight and look at how Pontecorvo produces such a powerful film of that time. But I think the time itself deserves a little more attention here. Why this film might have been made then, and how it hit audiences then. It was a special moment, which is not to say a wonderful moment.
No, I first saw the film, that's for sure. I first saw the film in the, I guess, winter of 1967. I saw it in the basement of the UMass Boston downtown campus. It was an old gas building converted into the school. And I saw it in a, I think it was sponsored by the Black Studies student group. I'm not sure of that. But in any case, when in the movie we see the historical character, a woman whose name was Zora Dreif, place two bombs in a cafe, a milk bar, occupied by celebrating happy young French teenagers, and walk out, and then the bomb goes off. When that happened, many of these Black students applauded. And I remember just feeling, well, you can imagine, because, of course, one inevitably identified with the French young people. They look a lot like us. The Algerians didn't. And that, I think, more than anything, shows how the climate in America that this film sort of came into and in a way gave, you know, helped to perhaps even orchestrate.
It's a fascinating and awful moment there when the bomb goes off in a scene that has become horribly familiar to us now. You know, it seems like every other week in Israel and in many other parts of the world and on a grand scale on 9/11 in New York and Washington. The music we hear behind us now from the Battle of Algiers is Ponte Corvo's camera drifting over the bodies of the French dead in a cafe that's just been blown to bits by three Algerian women. There's a kind of sympathy in this film, as powerful as it was to would-be revolutionaries, Jim Huberman, a kind of sympathy for all sides here. The bodies of these dead are treated almost with a pietà respect here.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, I think that the movie's fundamental sympathy is with the Algerians, but in a way, it's as if it were representing the flow of history.
You see, it has an almost Olympian detachment.
Well, yes, in a way, but I mean, you do feel a tremendous empathy for the victims. I mean, it doesn't. The movie does not, as we heard, shy away from recording the pain of the terrorism, and as was pointed out, I mean, when we look at the movie now, it has all kinds of contemporary resonance as well.
Who's released it now, and why? Has it been timed because of the occupation of Iraq, or was it already on its way back?
Well, it would seem so, but I believe that the outfit which is re-releasing it, Rialto Pictures, had it in mind. I mean, they've made a practice of sort of dusting off and restoring a number of European what would have been art house classics of the 50s and 60s. You know, the greatest black and white movies around, and this is one of them.
Pauline Kael called it the one great revolutionary sell of modern times, and I guess she means selling revolution.
I think that's what she meant, yes. I think that she meant that it was a, an emotionally galvanizing a movie, as it was for many people. I mean, the experience that Jack described was not uncommon. In fact, there were a number of articles which appeared in the New York Times and elsewhere in the late 60s and early 70s commenting on precisely this. I mean, sometimes the audience was made up predominantly of young blacks. Sometimes it was just young people. But it was considered newsworthy that
that their sympathies,
young Americans, yes, were
with the Algerians,
exactly,
with the rebels, with the terrorists. Jim Huberman, yeah. Jack Beatty, stand by. We're talking tonight about the black and white powerhouse, the Battle of Algiers, 1965, and back out now into a situation, well, where it resonates. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the black and white film classic from 1965, The Battle of Algiers. It is re-released right now. Here is a call to arms from that movie by the Algerian underground.
Front de Libération Nationale. Communiqué numéro 1. Peuple algérien. Notre action est dirigée contre le colonialisme. Le but est l'indépendance nationale avec la restauration de l'État algérien.
Here's the call to battle from the FLN. People of Algiers, our combat is directed against colonialism, our aim, independence, and restoration of the Algerian state in accordance with Islamic principles and the respect of basic liberties regardless of race or religion. To avoid bloodshed, we propose that the French authorities negotiate with us our right of self-determination. Algerians, it is your duty to your own country to restore its liberty, its victory. And on it goes, right into battle after battle in the streets of the Kasbah. I'm joined tonight by Jim Hoberman, senior film critic for The Village Voice, author of The Dream Life and our own Jack Beatty. Jim Hoberman, all kinds of applause for this film when it first came out. It won the Golden Lion at the 1966 Venice Film Festival. But the French delegation, and this is 10 years after the events that it depicts, walked out of that screening and the whole award ceremony.
Yes, well, it was still extraordinarily sensitive. I mean, Algeria achieved its independence in 1962,
mm-hmm.
but it was not without a terrorist war that spread to France as well. I mean, there was a right-wing paramilitary group that was planting bombs in metropolitan France.
And furious that Algeria had been lost.
That's right. And that's why to have the movie in the theaters would have been incredibly volatile. And
It wasn't in France until 1971. The opening scene almost of the film, just after the opening scene, is in a huge prison somewhere in Algiers. And one prisoner is being walked to the guillotine. You can hear the kind of budding, rumbling nationalism here in his call and the response from the prisoners in the film.
Allahu Akbar! Tahya al-Jazair! Tahya al-Jazair! Tahya al-Jazair! Tahya al-Jazair!
And the French prison warden's hand comes over his mouth, but the other prisoners take up the chant, and within a few seconds, the guillotine blade comes down. That rebel is gone, but many more in the film follow in his place. Jim Hoberman, you write that even at the time when this was released in the United States, 1967, lots of reviewers were making the connection between Algeria and Vietnam, even Algeria and America's inner cities. Jack Beatty, you describe hearing black Americans cheer when they saw the French bombed there. There was a sense that this was not just a French problem, and in other quarters, it was an American problem even then.
One of the things that had resonance, I think, for the American audience was that the initial war is fought against the police. It's that's who the Algerians have targeted, the police, and the terrorism comes out of that.
In the summer when there were riots in many American cities.
Yes, and when that was a tremendous issue. I mean, the most militant American black nationalists saw themselves as being in a war with the police.
Mm. You write that at the time in 67, both the Times reported that both the FBI and the Army had screened the film for their intelligence operatives, that at the famous trial of 13 Black Panthers who were charged with conspiracy to bomb public places, an undercover detective testified that one of the defendants, Lumumba Shakur, stepfather of murdered rapper Tupac Shakur, had told the detective that the Battle of Algiers was required viewing among American Black Panthers.
Yeah, they actually entered the movie as evidence in the trial, and one of the Panthers were acquitted. They were accused of conspiring to plant bombs in Midtown Manhattan department stores, but they were acquitted. And one of the jurors, in a book that he wrote about it, said that actually looking at the Battle of Algiers had the opposite effect, he thought, than the prosecution intended. It made him sympathetic.
And of course, the thing that catches us now is that we see the French and the Algerians pull deeper and deeper and deeper into violence, into this confrontation. At the beginning of the film, most Algerians depicted appear more or less oblivious to this, but acts of violence ratchet up one upon the other. Innocents get caught up in it. Pretty soon, those trying to drive the French out have got more and more sympathy around them. There's this terribly affecting scene we referenced earlier where three Algerian women in the Kasbah are shown changing out of their full head-to-toe robes and traditional garb into European garb so that they can carry bombs into the French portion of the city, the bombs that ultimately explode in a bar, a milk bar, an Air France office, and really turn this into a much deeper kind of violence. You say, Jim Hoberman, they've got a kind of cinema verite here that rivals Black Hawk Down, Bloody Sunday. I mean, this is a very early, effective, somehow drawing up of exactly what the tensions were.
Yeah, well, part of its greatness as a movie is that it's able to communicate this kind of immediacy in the scene that you're describing, which is really the key scene of the movie.
They're putting on the lipstick and the eyeliner and the kind of capri pants that they would not normally wear.
Yeah, I mean it's a complicated scene, and of course, as we've said, it means something different to us now, perhaps. But it's not just that. The terrorists are individualized, that we familiar with all of them, and it certainly they're all quite attractive too, which is, you know, adds something to it.
No shortage of kind of Che Guevara romance wrapped around these terrorists, in spite of the Olympian detachment you mentioned.
Yes, but you know you do get to see the victims who realize that they're doomed, and there's also this moment when the terrorists are interacting with the victims as well. So it's as if they have to acknowledge what they're about to do, or at least the humanity of the people they're about to destroy.
Jack Beatty, I have to say, I find that scene today even more affecting than years ago, when these three women, each in their turn, are in the bar or the milk bar or the Air France office with their purse or bag loaded with the bomb, scooting it under a table or the bar and looking around with the kind of even feminine empathy at the people around them that they know are about to be blown to smithereens. And you see them recognizing the humanity of their targets, and then in their eyes, after everything that they've seen done to their own comrades, making the decision that this is necessary and going ahead, having seen so many bombings now in Israel, in New York, to have this depicted so intimately, I find startling today. Again.
Yes, but you know, let's put it in context. As you say, the French were in Algeria from about 1830. There were, by 1945, nearly a million of them. They were called Pieds Noirs, mm-hmm. Blackfeet, a sort of slighting designation by metropolitan French, that the sun had burned their feet black. And the Algerians, by the hundreds of thousands, had fought in World Wars I and II. Mm-hmm. And in World War II, General de Gaulle, the leader of the Free French, made a declaration where he said that after the war, France would move to shepherd its colonies toward independence. And on VE Day, 1945, in the town of Sétif, which is in eastern Algeria, Algerians demonstrated for independence, and the police tried to take down their banners, and violence broke out, and there was a pogrom, killing of 50 or 60 Europeans. This was then followed by the French army intervening and actually bombing Algerian villages. This was augmented by the violence, the paramilitary violence of Pieds Noirs, mm-hmm. who killed, some people think, as many as 15,000 people in reprisal. Mm. So those were the essential elements of the Algerian war: the terrorism of the Algerians, the terrorism of the Pieds Noirs against them, and the army, the great repressive force on the outside. And when the war broke out in 1954, the French had just lost at Dien Bien Phu, and the war broke out in Algeria, and it lasted for 8 years. Alistair Horn's great book on it is called A Savage War of Peace. It may have killed more than a million people. And the radicalizing dimension of it, of course, was the repressive violence of the French army, which had over 500,000 men there at one point, and the Pied-Noirs. Because as late even as 1958, almost 90%, more than 90% of Algerians voted for a kind of condominium with France, sort of halfway house. Mm-hmm. But it was this constant violence that radicalized more and more people, and that you see reflected in the hatred, in the psychology that can't be overcome by looking at the Europeans and the psychology of those women. They're looking back on Sétif. They're looking mm-hmm. back on these massacres. They're looking back on torture. And that's hardened their hearts.
Jim Oberman, take us into the specific lessons that the Pentagon, for example, may be looking at when they look at this film. I want to look at larger lessons as well and then see what kind of translates to Iraq and what doesn't. But in 1965, when this came out, what was Pontecorvo saying, describing, defining about how insurrection, terrorist cells worked?
Well, in some ways, it's quite practical, because he points out that each cell only has three members, so that even when somebody is tortured, they can only give up two others, and they're enjoined to hold out for 24 hours. So
under torture,
yes,
so that the others can spread the word and get away.
That's right. And you know, there's sort of attention given to the creation of safe houses and the ability of the urban guerrillas to blend into the general population and so on. In addition to this quite detailed scene where the women in effect disguise themselves as kind of Frenchified Algerian women and are allowed to pass through mm-hmm. a very elaborate checkpoint.
So they're depicted as effectively getting to the French again and again, killing policemen. When the paratroopers show up, they're going to change the game. Colonel Mathieu says, the basis of our job is intelligence. The method is interrogation. And shortly after, we see a series of torture sequences, which are just crushing, even now to see, with the kind of music behind them that brings an almost religious quality to these torn and tortured and hanging bodies of the Algerians, Jim Hoberman.
Yeah, as with the scene of the victims of the bombing, similar
of the French in the bars and
yeah.
so on.
Yeah,
here's a Bach chorale behind these scenes of torture.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned bringing out what the Pentagon saw in this. I mean, I wish I could. I would actually love to know what the conversation was in the Pentagon after the screening or screenings of the Battle of Algiers that took place in September. I think I wonder, first of all, whose idea this was. I mean, there must be some old lefty or film buff, somebody
remembered, a neocon maybe.
Yes, you know, I don't know, you know, who thought of it, but then I would have loved to have heard the discussion, because, you know, of course there are some parallels that one can draw, but it's a completely different historical situation too, and so it's an example, I think, of a movie being taken to mean something new. And quite different than whatever its original intentions were, and different obviously than it was for the new leftists who saw it in 1968
and celebrated it then. Jack, what do you think? The Pentagon watching this, of course, the American presence in Iraq is defined entirely differently as a liberation, as the path to democracy, and all the rest. Yet Pontecorvo was a keen observer here, and they must be looking at the way he's depicted how the social psychology of that situation in Algiers, at least as depicted here, shifted when too much weight or the wrong kind of weight was put in the wrong place. The boot was too heavy at the wrong time, and made the Kasbah at least impossible for the French to govern.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the accelerant of the Algerian Revolution was the French violence, the violence of the French army. It radicalized, hundreds of thousands of Algerians who, as I say, felt a loyalty to some sort of relation to France. Yes, it's a but of course Iraq, as you say, is a very different situation. What is so though is that this experience, the Battle of Algiers, the post-colonial moment, the liberation struggles, and colonialism, these are the grammar. These are the sort of mental, this is the mental climate in which the Arab world perceives the West, perceives the United States. Now, we can say, well, we have no designs, we're not going to put a colony. But the fact is, the longer we stay there, the more we are going to feed suspicions that cannot be arrested by any amount of propaganda, because it comes out of the experience of whole peoples fighting against European colonialism, and of course, some say Israeli colonialism would be a form of that. So the longer you stay, the worse the potential for this sort of nationalist violence against you. On the other hand, if you leave too soon, chaos. This is what's called, I guess, putting yourself in a kind of cul-de-sac.
And the French colonel turns to a press that's questioning him. Very hard, pressing him hard at a press conference in Algiers, putting him on the spot. He turns to them and says, it's my turn to ask you a question. Should France stay in Algeria? And then he says, if your answer is yes, you must accept the consequences. But there's a kind of logic, a cause and effect that the Pentagon, Jim Hubbard, must be desperate to avoid here.
Yeah, well, that's another key moment in the movie, because the colonel, who is clearly is shown as intelligent and also as in some respects the most articulate character in the movie, just brings it down to the essence that if the French are to stay in Algeria, they must do so by any means necessary. Mm. Now, in a way, our invasion of Iraq, which was done as part of the war on terrorism, suggests something very similar. If you're serious about a war against terrorism, then any means are necessary, can justify it.
Including the invasion of an entire country. Jim Hoberman,
yeah.
Stand by. Jack Beatty, hear the paratroopers crashing into the Kasbah behind us here. We're talking tonight about the Battle of Algiers, 1965, looking back on it with re-release today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Allez, debout là-dedans. Tout le monde dort.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the 1965 film classic, The Battle of Algiers, depicting urban insurrection by the Algerians against the French in the mid-1950s. My guest tonight, J. Jim Hoberman, senior film critic for The Village Voice, author of The Dream Life, Movies, Media, and the Mythology of the 60s, and our own Jack Beatty with us as well. We've been talking about the lessons that the Pentagon may be drawing from this film today, the lessons that audiences will draw from it today when they look back on the depiction of an uprising half a century ago, a different time, and in many circumstances, a different dynamic. But there, I wonder, Jack, what's happened to the kind of meta-narrative here? You know that for decades after the mid-20th century, there were these torn sympathies across the world. Of course, the imperialist powers, on the one hand, struggling to hang on, but in many quarters, ready to let go. Today, Jim Hoberman was just saying, different situation. We've got global terrorism reaching right into the first world, and the notion of liberation rather than continued colonialism as the framework for what's going on. And yet, as you say, there are big kind of almost poetic perceptions of what's happening in these meeting of cultures, meeting of peoples, meeting of armed forces here. Is the old liberator, conqueror, colonial, native gone, or are we still in the grip of that to some extent?
You mean the colonial, the anti-colonialist revolution against the oppressor, that sort of thing?
Yeah. Is it inevitable that that at some point engulfs what's going on in Iraq, or is the mighty American propaganda machine and reality enough to hold that off and say, no, this is different, this is the 21st century, this is not the Battle of Algiers?
Well, yeah, I mean, let's hope. But the same dynamics are there. I mean, you have violence by a tiny minority. And then you have the army trying to deal with it, and you have these killings, a family killed, shot dead last week. And this is multiplied everywhere. And then you have the demonstrations, and people are shot in the demonstrations. This goes on.
This is in Iraq today.
This is in Iraq today. These our forces are doing this. They're defending themselves. But this is how it happens. This is what happens when you put soldiers in situations like this. And the question is, you know, is there a tipping point? Does there come a moment when the affront, the daily affront of this kind of violence, the lack of jobs, the lack of being able to deliver on our promises to give any substance to this liberation, does there come a moment when the thing tips, when what is violence by a few who represent a hated regime becomes amalgamated and with passions more widely held? And if that happens, that happened to the Israelis in Lebanon, where they were greeted as liberators because they forced the PLO out of southern Lebanon, the PLO were tyrannizing over the Shiite Muslims. But there was a tipping point. There was an incident. The Israelis drove through a funeral and people were run over, and that did it. And they had 20 years of guerrilla war against them.
Jim Hoberman, that must be part of what the Pentagon is looking to avoid as they sit in a darkened room watching this film today.
Well, I think Jack made a very good point vis-a-vis what the Pentagon might learn from the Battle of Algiers, and that is that it provides a framework or a kind of illumination of the third worldist or Arab nationalist worldview. Which would be very one would hope that that's something that they are considering in their strategy. You know, there's a great moment in another film which is extremely relevant, coincidentally, to this moment, the documentary The Fog of War, the long interview with Robert McNamara.
Errol Morris's film.
Exactly, where, you know, there are lessons that he derives from McNamara's experience, and one of them is empathize with your enemy. This is what McNamara says. Mm. Perhaps, you know, that they were studying the Battle of Algiers to try and understand the Algerian mindset, because I would say that we as a nation know far, far less about Iraqi culture, the history of Iraq, than the French knew about Algeria.
There's a moment in the film, late in the film, where, as the French become more and more frustrated at their inability to calm these waters, and there's so much blood that's flowed, a French soldier shouting at practically a mob, an Algerian standing on their flat rooftops in Algiers, and a mob in the street, and saying, "Return to your homes. What do you want?" he shouts almost plaintively. And the answer comes back through the mist and dust of all the turmoil there: independence. It strikes me, Jack, that there is no such clear, simple word to come back in Iraq these days.
No, and, you know, Saddam Hussein is one of the most brutal dictators and murderers in history, and these people are rid of him. And they're all of them, I'm sure, except for this minority, grateful for that. So there's a powerful card the Americans can play. But as I say, the historical context of Western intervention is not a promising one there. And it works. The longer you stay, the more it works against you. But, you know, there's another aspect of this, and that is the not so much the similitude between the Battle of Algiers and the battle in Iraq, but the similitude between France and America, between what happened. This war damaged French democracy. There were coups. There were suppression of the press. There were political trials. There were attempts to assassinate de Gaulle. The military tried to take over. French democracy was undermined by this imperial war. And, you know, that's what the Founding Fathers say. Read the Federalist Papers. They were haunted by the Roman Republic. Rome became an empire. It cracked the Republic. It corrupted the Republic. And that is a frightening prospect, not so much of what's going to happen in Iraq, but if another terrorist or more terrorist incidents happen here. Tommy Franks, our commander in Iraq, was recently quoted as saying, you know, if another terrorist incident happens in the United States, people are going to have to get used to the military playing a greater role in domestic affairs. A frightening thought. That's how the terrorists, as many people would say, win, by doing what happened in France or what could happen here.
Well, a parting note, the one professional actor in this big film, Jean Mortain, who played the French colonel, was actually a signatory to a manifesto against the war in Algeria and later suffered professionally as a result. So even one of the participants in this film. It's out. If you get a chance, see it. It's a great historical document. You can't help but learn something from it again today and have a good long discussion about how it relates and does not relate to the United States and Iraq. Jim Hoberman, it's been great having you tonight. Thanks so much for joining us for this discussion.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Jim Hoberman, senior film critic for The Village Voice, author of The Dream Life. For more information on the Battle of Algiers, go to our website at onpointradio.org. In a moment, I'll be rejoined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
It is time for America to take the next steps. Today, I announce a new plan to explore space and extend a human presence across our solar system.
From the very beginning, there was a conviction that Saddam Hussein was a bad person and that he needed to go.
The idea that he came into office with a predisposition to invade Iraq, I think, is a total misunderstanding of the situation.
To those of you who believed in this effort, I say take heart. You can claim the nobility of moving our country forward and of opening up possibilities for all our daughters.
You are going to see some tough campaigning. It is a tight race. And you're going to see people say everything. The folks in Washington have been there for a long, long time, and they aren't going to give up without a fight.
Mr. Fastow will be sentenced to 10 years in federal prison. That is 10 years without parole, without chance of reduction.
It's not as good as an election, but we believe it's important to return sovereignty and return the dignity to the Iraqi people on the timeline that we've agreed, which is by the end of June.
Coldest readings I've been able to find this morning, Saranac Lake, New York, now reporting 36 below. And just across the border in Sherbrooke, Quebec, and Saint-Yovite, Quebec, it is 42 degrees below zero.
And there's a week President Bush announces an ambitious plan to build a space station on the moon and eventually send people to Mars. Former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill lashes out at his former boss, among the charges that President Bush was looking for a way to oust Saddam Hussein within days of his inauguration. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld dismissed O'Neill's tell-all tales. Former Senator Carol Mosley Braun drops out of the presidential race. The race in Iowa appears to tighten to a four-way dead heat as Monday's caucuses approach. We heard there from Howard Dean. Former Enron Chief Financial Officer Andrew Fastow pleads guilty to two counts of conspiracy. Tens of thousands of Shiites in Iraq demand early elections in the streets, but U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer sticks to his plan for indirect elections in June before a planned summer handover of U.S. authority to Iraqis, and a record-setting cold snap paralyzes much of the Northeast. Jack, it's cold here, but Iowans know cold. I'm sure they won't be deterred one way or another. They're headed to their caucus places on Monday night.
They sure are, and what a drama this has been. I mean, the cliche is a week is a lifetime in politics, and we've seen that, haven't we? I mean, just a couple of weeks ago, it looked like it was going to be Howard Dean or Gephardt. Now, look, four-way tie.
This is not a cakewalk. It's some kind of big square dance out there.
It really is. And, you know, during the we don't know what's going to happen. But during the 80s, there was this scheme called fratricide. This was going to be the way that we defended against Soviet missiles. And we were going to somehow send signals to the, to say two missiles that were coming at our silos to hit the hit each other, to commit fratricide, leaving the silo untouched. Well, something like that, I think, is happening in Iowa with the fratricide between Gephardt and
Howard Dean.
Mm-hmm. They are running attack ads against each other. And attack ads work. They drive down the other guy's numbers. But they also, in a multi-candidate race, work against the person who uses them because people don't like them. Right. Hence, fratricide.
So the rising mushroom clouds are labeled Kerry and Edwards there.
I think so, because that's been the trend. They're positive. They're going up. Dean and Gephardt are negative. They're going down.
Well, it's fascinating. I mean, for all the talk about Iowa, of course, it's only Jimmy Carter in 76 and George W. Bush in 2000 who won there and won the White House. So a lot can happen and will happen between Monday night and the nominations, let alone the final election in November.
That's for sure. And, you know, what's striking about the Iowa voters, and you had the wonderful sample of them on the other night, is how informed they are. And that may be the difference between them and, say, the rest of Americans who, for one, who don't have the time and don't have this as their ritual to dig into every issue. But this is the striking thing about me, just how informed and concerned even the Iowa voter on the street seems.
I was struck, speaking with those voters, by this year, this time out, how they're looking for the candidates with the issues that they care about and the positions that they want, but more than ever, these Iowa Democrats seem to be looking for the candidates that the rest of America would like, that the rest of America might vote for.
You know, that's absolutely true. I mean, strategic voting, I think, is, you know, for a while it looked like that wasn't going to be so, and people were going to vote for it with their hearts. But I have heard that, too. People are just making I like this candidate very much, but I don't think he can win. I mean, a kind of canny voting that we may well see something similar to that in New Hampshire. But another thing in this race is the political wives. John Kerry's wife was thought to be a liability. I heard someone,
the rich Teresa Hines.
Yeah, I have watched her in groups. She is making that guy seem more human than he does. She is a magnetic presence, and she knows the issue. She's a kind of exotic and beautiful looking, and she had this audience for about an hour in her hands, and you could just see the Kerry meter going up.
And then John Edwards' wife, who, while he looks like still like a kid, she looks her age, and
she does,
and helps him by looking her age next to her boyish husband.
That's right. That's right. And it absolutely helps him. It makes him seem it humanizes him. And of course, she's a woman who's accomplished a great deal in her own life.
And then, of course, the very interesting Mrs. Dean, or I don't even know if she goes by Mrs. Dean, who doesn't make the scene and doesn't apologize for it.
Doesn't apologize at all. She has her medical practice, has her patients, and yet you wonder, does that hurt Howard Dean? Because we've just mentioned these candidates whose wives, I think, palpably do a lot for them as campaigners, and Howard Dean's missing that.
Jack, a lot to look for next week as Paul Bremer struggles in Washington and with at the UN with what to do to smooth the handover to Iraqis this summer. Shiite leaders now saying they want direct elections. We'll talk about that next week. Plenty more to come. Big trigger gun, starting gun for the campaign on Monday night. Looking forward to looking at all of it with you. Have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us.
And to you. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.